I don't know. It's just an interesting name. And of course, ever since coming here, I've gotten associated with a Haggai, and I don't know if Haggai and Haggai are related to each other, but they're awfully close. The name Haggai is Hebrew, of course, and it means festive one. I don't know if Haggai means festive one too or not, but Haggai means festive one or related to a festival day. Leads some commentators to think that Haggai was born on a festival day, and that's the way his parents commemorated his birth. I remember a friend of my brother's when I was growing up. His name was Joe, and he was born in March, and his birthday was on a saint's day, I think. And I don't remember the saint. It wasn't Patrick, because I think it was the 18th. And he was always grateful that his mother didn't name him after the saint that was born on that day, as Catholics often do, because it's probably Aloysius or something like that, you know. But anyway, it was not uncommon in Jewish homes, especially devout Jewish homes, if a child was born on a day associated with something, to name them in some way or another to commemorate that fact. And so Haggai became a prophet. Some people think that he was rather old by the time he wrote this book. They think, given some of the things in the book, that maybe he saw the temple in Jerusalem before it was destroyed by the Babylonians. And now here he is with the people 70 years after the captivity began, encouraging them to rebuild the temple. And he doesn't have a lot to say to us. I'm sure he had a lot more to say to the people of the time, but only two chapters of his prophecy have been preserved for us, and that's what we had for today. And I'd like to share with you chapter 1. In the second year of King Darius, on the first day of the sixth month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. This is what the Lord Almighty said. The people are saying, the time has not yet come for the Lord's house to be rebuilt. So the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Is it a time for you yourselves to be living in paneled houses while this house remains a ruin? Now this is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. You have planted much, but you have harvested little. You eat, but you're never satisfied. You drink, but you never have your fill. You put on clothes, but you're not warm. You earn wages, only to put them in a purse with holes in it. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought to your ways. Go up into the mountains and bring down timber and build this house, so I may take pleasure in it and be honored, says the Lord. You expected much, but see, it turned out to be little. What you brought home, I blew away. Why? Declares the Lord Almighty. Because of my house, which remains a ruin, while each of you is busy with his own house. Therefore, because of you, the heavens have withheld their dew and the earth its crops. I called for a drought on the fields and the mountains, on the grain, the new wine, the oil, and whatever the ground produces, on men and cattle, and on the labor of your hands. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the whole remnant of the people obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the message of the prophet Haggai, because the Lord their God had sent him. Therefore, the people feared the Lord. I was tempted just to read the whole two chapters. But I thought, no, that's enough. That gives us the feel of the book, gives us an idea of the message of Haggai. Haggai was a prophet to the remnant. The remnant is a word that's used quite often in referring to the Jewish people who came back from exile. Christians in some denominations have sort of stolen that word, remnant, and used it to refer to themselves, some of them, because they think they're the only faithful Christians in the Christian community. Remnant refers to a small group of people within a larger group. And it comes from the prophecies given at the time of the Babylonian captivity, where God said, I will destroy this nation, I will throw the people to the four winds, but I will keep for myself a remnant, and the remnant will return and will once again settle in the land. And so, true to the prophecy of Jeremiah, 70 years after the exile began, Cyrus, king of Persia, issued a decree allowing any Jew to return to Jerusalem who wanted to do so, to return to their homeland in Judea. Cyrus was smart. Cyrus was a Persian. And the Persians had just defeated the Babylonians. And this area of the world had gone through some monumental changes in the last 100 years. First, the Assyrian Empire, 100 years before this time, was quite powerful and prosperous. No one thought it would ever end. But just like that, the Babylonians overthrew the Assyrians, conquered the city of Nineveh, and established the Babylonian Empire, which thrived for 80, 90 years. Just like that, overnight, the Persian army slipped through the defenses of the capital city of Babylon, killed the army and the king and royal family in their beds, practically. And now the Persians are in charge. The Assyrians, when they conquered a nation, would take everybody from that nation and transplant them to another place that they had conquered. And would take the people of that place and move them to this place. And that way you had a total shifting of population. And the conquered people were no longer living in their homeland. They had nothing to fight for. And the Assyrians figured this would eliminate any tendency of conquered peoples to rise up and try to regain their independence. How can you regain your independence when you have no land to call your own? Well, the Babylonians had a different policy. What they would do when they conquered a nation, they would just take the best of the people. Who wants all the criminals anyway? They would take the smartest, the brightest, the most promising, and would ship them off to their capital of Babylon to be re-educated, debriefed, so to speak, and would leave the poorest of the people to till the land and get the crops in the land. The Persians, what they would do, they would take the captured people that the Assyrians and the Babylonians had captured and relocated. They would welcome them to go back to their homeland. See, that way the Persians are the good guys. They would even encourage them to rediscover their religious roots in the hopes that by establishing and encouraging a religious atmosphere in these nations, they would be encouraging these people to pray for them, the Persians. And through the prayers of various people to various gods, the Persian Empire would be maintained. And so Cyrus allowed whoever wanted to go back and reestablish the city of Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And there were some who left, some who were familiar with the prophecy. They said, this is our time. It's the time Jeremiah spoke of. Let's go back. But there were others who had also followed Jeremiah's teaching when he said, when the Babylonians take you into exile, settle wherever they put you and do your best. Build houses and stay in them and pray for the people among whom you were living because you're going to be there for a while. Well, in the process of doing that, many people had actually developed rather nice lives for themselves. They were comfortable. It was only the grandparents who remembered what life was like in Judah. For the younger generations, the land of Babylon was all they ever knew. It was home to them. And when the call came, when the invitation was given, they said, well, you go ahead and go, but we kind of like it where we are. Sounds sort of like a lot of Christians, doesn't it, who say, well, you live the Christian life if you want to, but we're kind of comfortable living the world's way. And the world is our home, and so we might as well make ourselves at home. But the remnant were the people who said, well, this is where we live, but it's not our home. Our home is Jerusalem. Our home is Judea, the hills of Judea. That's our home. That's the land God gave us. We're strangers here in Babylon, in Persia now. Home is Israel. When they were given the opportunity, they took it. They left full of enthusiasm. They figured, God is going to prosper us. We're going to rebuild the city. It'll be like the old days. It'll be like the days of King David and King Solomon. So they went back to Jerusalem and they began to rebuild the temple. Almost immediately they faced problems, as we read about when we read the book of Ezra. The people of the land were not too encouraged by the idea of all these strangers relocating. Talk about illegal aliens. The land didn't belong to the Israelites anymore, according to the people settling in the land, the Samaritans in particular. The land was theirs. And here are all these foreigners coming into the land and settling. You can imagine the problems that they had, the same problems they have today with the Palestinians. These people have come into our land, have built their homes in our land. Now they want to rebuild their temple. No way. And so the people who returned to the land began to face ridicule, and when ridicule didn't stop them, they began to face real danger. Danger to life and property. And so the building of the temple lagged, and the people began to pursue their own lives. And the work on the temple was forgotten. And it's now 14 years later, and Haggai the prophet, who may, as I mentioned before, he may have actually seen the temple before it was destroyed, now sees what amounts to a pile of rubble and says to the people, don't you think it's time we rebuild the temple? Now's not the time. Things are too unsettled. We haven't established friendly enough relations with the people of the land yet. No, I'll give it more time. Meanwhile, the people are living in fancy homes, buying fancy things, and they never have enough money. Sounds sort of like America today, doesn't it? Fancy homes, paneled walls, making lots of money, but never having enough. The first chapter of Haggai presents a population that is almost frantic with work. They're working, working, working. But they're not getting what their labors deserve. They're planting crops, and they harvest enough to make a living, but they never harvest quite as much as they think they should. They're making all this money so that they can establish themselves and become comfortable, but by the time they've made themselves comfortable, the money has run out, and they never have enough. I love that imagery of putting money into a purse that has holes in it. To me, that describes our culture to a T, especially now with the frenzy over Christmas shopping. I was thinking the other day, you know, when I was working at the sports store before I embarked on a career, when all I had to worry about was school that my parents were paying for, I took all the money I was making from the sports store, and you know, they said you should save that up because now's when you're making it, so save it up. I didn't save it up. Christmas came and I bought presents for everybody. I loved it. I can't do that anymore because my purse has lots of big holes in it. I go to the mall and I look around and I say, boy, if I had the money, I'd get this for Matthew, I'd get this for Megan. Oh, Tammy would love this, you know. Then there's all my friends, and then there's family. I never get one thing on the list purchased, though. because my money is going into a purse with holes in it. Or you might say it's going into a purse that has a wallet for medical expenses, it has a wallet for house expenses and utilities and so forth, it's got a wallet in it for money that has to go to the car, and when all that money is allocated, and of course there's money that has to go to the work of the Lord, there's nothing left. I feel like the people of Haggai said, you work, you earn wages only to put the money in a purse with holes in it. Haggai notices this. He sees how busy the people are, but he sees the temple in ruin. He sees how active the people are, but they're not praying, and they're not gathering together for the festivals. Something's not right here. And yet he hears how dissatisfied they are. The people are pouring themselves into a lifestyle that leaves them unfulfilled and unhappy, and meanwhile the work of the Lord is not getting done. This doesn't make sense. So Haggai shares his concern with the people. Two short chapters. One chapter is only 15 verses long. The other chapter is 23 verses long. 38 chapter verses, that's all. 38 verses. In some books, that'd be one chapter. And yet, in those two chapters, there are some words that Haggai uses over and over and over again. We've discovered, as we read through the Bible, repetition is a technique that God uses to emphasize something important. Well, when you've got a book that's only 38 verses long, and you get words or phrases that are repeated 4 and 5 times in the short space of 38 verses, you begin to take notice. And there are two phrases that are repeated in the book of Haggai. The first phrase is this: give careful thought. This is what Haggai's been doing. Give careful thought to your situation. Give careful thought to what is happening. Give careful thought to your ways. Chapter 1. You've planted much but harvested little. You eat but you're never full. You drink, it's never enough. You put on clothes but you're never warm. You earn wages only to put them in a purse with holes in it. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Give careful thought, there it is the second time, to your ways. Get working on the temple. The reason you're not satisfied is because God will not let you be satisfied. You are His people. You're the remnant. You're the ones dedicated to Him. And yet, where are you? You're here, you're there. You're everywhere, but here. Give careful thought. You run around like chickens with their heads cut off. Busy, 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 but you never get anything accomplished. Always something else to run off to. Chapter 2. Give careful thought from this day forward. Take a look back at what you've just experienced. When anyone came to a heap of measures expecting 20, there were only 10. When anyone went to a wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. That's how it's been. Now Haggai gives them a challenge, and I got to tell you, I got a lot of respect for Haggai. Maybe it's because he's old. You know, when you're old, you can say things like this and get away with it. But Haggai actually puts his money where his mouth is. He lays his cards on the table and he says, now, give careful thought. Today, this day, on which you rededicate yourself to the rebuilding of the temple, now you take a look and you see if God won't bless you from this day forward. 1 year from now, I want you to look back on this day. Mark it on your calendars. This is the day we rededicated ourselves to the work of the Lord. You see if 1 year from now you are not happier, more satisfied people than you are today for all of your running around. You've lost something. You've lost the thing that gives meaning to life. You've lost your dedication. Reminds me of Mary and Martha. Martha was so busy getting things ready for Jesus to come. Mary, she couldn't wait until he came so she could sit at his feet and listen to him. Now, who was happier? Well, that's easy. Martha's complaining. And she says to Jesus, "Don't you care that my sister's out there listening to you when she should be in here helping me?" And Jesus says, "Look, we all make choices. She has made a better choice. I'm not taking it away from her." Which one was happy? Mary was happy. She was listening to the words of God. Martha was not happy. All she could see was the work that needed to be done. Actually, it's a message that's repeated quite often through Scripture. Very familiar situation in the New Testament in the book of Hebrews. Maybe you remember us going through that book before. The book of Hebrews, written to Hebrew Christians, because they were facing a problem very similar to the problems faced in Jerusalem by the remnant. They were dedicated to Jesus Christ. They saw in him the fulfillment of all the promises in the Bible about the Messiah. They were delighted that the Messiah had finally come, had transformed their lives. Only one problem. In following the Messiah, they had to leave behind their friends and their family. You think back 3 days to Thanksgiving. How important was family to you on that day? How would it feel to you if Thanksgiving or Christmas rolled around and you were told not to come to family gathering because you believed in Jesus and your family thought that that was a slap in the face to them? A lot of you know what it feels like to have family members make fun of you because of choices you've made for your faith. These Hebrew Christians had made those choices and they were being cut off from their families. They were being kicked out of their synagogue. Just like the remnant who was facing persecution and rebuilding the temple. They were beginning to wonder, is it worth it? Can't we have both? Can't we worship Jesus in our hearts and celebrate family when we're together? And so they began to tone down their love for Jesus. They began to tone down their realization that Jesus was the one thing that made life meaningful. They began to find meaning in other things, especially family. They began to fall away. The book of Hebrews was written to them as an encouragement to them not to fall away, because what they'd be doing, they'd be trading away life eternal for something that's only going to fade away. And I'll bet you, as they began to trade off their faith in Jesus for the things they left behind, I'll bet you they were experiencing the same thing the people of Jerusalem were. Well, yes, we're with family, but it's not the same. Yes, I have the synagogue back, but I don't enjoy it like I used to. God is saying, I know, I'm doing that to you. I'm withholding your pleasure from you, because you're in danger of losing something much more valuable. Like the church at Ephesus in the book of Revelation, to whom Jesus said, you have lost your early zeal, or as most Bibles put it, you've lost your first love. You're not as into me as you used to be. You're distracted by other things, many of them religious. Many of them have to do with the church's mission, but they don't have to do with me. And now you're so busy, we don't know each other anymore. And you never have time for me. It's like the parable that Jesus told of the man who's having a feast. His son's getting married, so he has a wedding feast. He has all these people invited to it. But when the servants go out and tell the people that the wedding couple has finally arrived and it's time for the feast, well, one says, well, I just bought a cow. You trade down a marriage feast to look at a cow? Another person said, well, I bought a field and I have to check it out. Look, the field's going to be there after the feast. Another person said, I got married. Now this guy's being honest. I got married, I can't come. Too many other things. He's too busy. He's got too much on his mind. God becomes last on the list. I'll do it if I have the time. I'll come to church if I feel rested when I wake up. I'll go to prayer service if there's nothing else on my calendar. This is the situation that Haggai was addressing. And so he gave them this challenge. Four times he says to them, give careful thought to your deeds and the situation up until this time. How happy are you really? How satisfied are you really? How worthwhile is your life really? Now, I offer you a challenge. Dedicate yourselves to the Lord. Live for Him first. Give up that overtime that would give you the extra money to buy a widescreen TV. Dedicate yourself to me first. Do other things if you have the time for it, not me. Don't say to me, I'll spend time with you if I'm not busy with other things. You say that to the other things on your schedule. You put me first, and then you see whether suddenly you're not experiencing the fullness and the joy that somehow you're not getting from your busy life. So another thing I give Haggai a lot of credit for, he's the only prophet I can think of offhand, and maybe there are others, but at the moment I can't think of any. He's the only prophet to Israel whose prophecies sparked a revival. The people listened to him. At the end of the first chapter, Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people. I am with you, declares the Lord. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah. And he stirred up the spirit of Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. And he stirred up the spirit of the whole remnant of the people. And they came and began the work on the house of the Lord. They listened to him. They followed him. Must be nice. There's only one other prophet I can think of whose words were listened to, whose message sparked a revival, and that was Jonah. But he wasn't speaking to the Israelites at the time. He was speaking to the Assyrians. So Haggai gives a challenge. Same challenge Malachi is going to give in 2 weeks. Put the Lord to the test. Do this. In Haggai's case, build the temple. In Malachi's case, give to the Lord what is due to him, particularly the tithe. And then see if he won't open the heavens and pour down on you a blessing so great that your pockets will not be able to contain it all. Or as Jesus said, it will be poured out to you a healthy measure, pressed down and shaken and overflowing. That's the measure God gives to those who are dedicated to Him. But to those who look for their joy in other places, why should God give them fulfillment when they're not seeking Him? Then to those who followed His advice and rededicated themselves to the work of rebuilding the temple, Haggai gives a second message, and this is the second phrase that's repeated. It's repeated 3 times in one verse. Actually, 4 times. Fourth time is not in exactly the same words, but it's the same message. The beginning of the second chapter, on the 25th day of the 7th month, the word of the Lord came through the prophet Haggai. Speak to Zerubbabel, here we go again, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to Joshua, son of Jehozadak the high priest, and to the remnant of the people. Ask them, who of you is left who saw this house in its former glory? Like Haggai probably did. How does it look to you now? Pretty skimpy, doesn't it? Does it seem to you like nothing? Well, be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak the high priest. Be strong, all you people of the land, declares the Lord, and do the work, for I am with you, declares the Lord. This is what I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit remains with you. Do not fear. What a powerful message for Haggai to say. This is what I promised you when I brought you out of Egypt, and my spirit is still with you today. The same spirit that brought you freedom from tyranny is bringing you freedom again, but you're too busy to receive it. Now that tyranny is not a foreign power like Egypt or Babylon or Persia or Assyria, now the tyranny is right here. It's the tyranny within. The tyranny that says, I've got to do this. I've got to have that. I've got to spend my time here and there and there. And God says, you know, I'm over here. Maybe later. Right now I'm busy here and here and here. And God's like, over here. Maybe later. Maybe later. After all, I'm going to have all eternity with you. And God says, want to bet? Maybe. And maybe not. We don't know each other anymore. You're too busy. And you're not busy enough. You're too busy over there. You're never busy here. You don't show yourself to me. You don't reveal your thoughts to me in prayer. You don't participate with the congregation, with the multitudes, with the family of God. I'm over here. How about we spend some time together? Haggai is a brave prophet. He dares to say, put God first and just see what will happen. But when you do, you're going to have to be strong. You're going to have to not fear, because you're going to be giving up a lot of things. You're really going to have to want me. But you stick with me. And then you just look and you just see what I will do for you. Mark the day on your calendar. And then you take a look at how things are after and how they were before. This is our challenge. How much can we appreciate what God has done for us? How meaningful can that become in our lives? Can it push out everything else? Can it become the most important thing in my life? My identity as a child of God? I'm going to close with a short illustration from a fellow who founded a group called Voice of the Martyrs. He was Jewish. And Orthodox Jewish, and became a Christian. And the first church he served was a very small church. A church whose mindset was one of pessimism, one of jealousy. The other churches around us are doing so much more. They're so much bigger than we are. They're so much more successful. They try one program after another to try and increase their numbers. And finally he said to them, maybe we're going about this wrong. Maybe instead of trying to do more, maybe instead of trying to become more, maybe we should just learn to love God more. And so he put all the emphasis on, this is what God has done for us. This is the kind of God we serve. And the people began to rediscover how great and how good and how loving God was. They began to genuinely love the Lord. And they found that that's all they needed. Now, whether the church grew or not, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. What matters is they found themselves. They knew what God wanted of them. He wanted a congregation that was sold out to Him, not divided between many other loyalties. He wanted a congregation of people whose hearts were totally devoted to Him, because they knew that He was totally sold out for them. He had given everything He could give for them. And now it's time for us to return the favor. Heavenly Father, I pray that today might be one of those Haggai days, a day to mark on the calendar, a day that in weeks and months to come, we will look back to and say, this was the day I began to get a new appreciation for who God is and what He can mean in my life. Thank You, Father, for Your patience, for still being there when we finally give up on pursuing so many other things and go back to pursuing the one thing that truly matters. Amen.